This recording was made at an open meeting of the Federal Election Commission on Thursday, February 23rd. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning. The Federal Election Commission open session for Thursday, February 23rd, 2006 will come to order. First item up is correction and approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move the correction and approval of the minutes for the open meeting of February 9th, 2006, as set forth in Agenda Document 06-06.
Everyone's heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries by a vote of 6-0. Next item up on our agenda, final rules for the definitions of to solicit and to direct. This is the seventh rulemaking as required by the Shays litigation. And, Mr. Vice Chairman, we have a couple late submitted documents.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move for the suspension of the rules for the timely submission of documents to consider agenda documents 06-08A and 06-08B.
Everyone's heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries by the vote of all six commissioners present. I think I'll just spend a couple minutes talking briefly about the goals behind Agenda Document 068A, which I offered along with my colleagues, Commissioner Mason and Commissioner Von Spakovsky. There's no question that the current rule for what is a solicitation must change. The Circuit Court ruling made very clear that, in the minds of the panel, the current regulation did not survive Chevron review, did not survive step one of Chevron. I think based on a fundamental misreading of the current rule, because the Circuit Court made clear that they viewed the current rule as only reaching explicit requests for funds, so-called magic words, phraseology, limited in scope. I don't think that was ever the intention of the agency to have the rule be limited that way, and in all fairness, I don't think it's a fair reading of the explanation and justification that the agency issued in 2002, but be that as it may, that's how the Circuit Court construed our current regulation as limited to explicit pitches for money. So as I read the Circuit Court ruling, the real heart of the concern is that our regulations in this area must cover indirect and implicit requests for funds as well as express requests for funds, and that we need to make that as plain as possible in the regulations. And the agenda document that I've co-authored is designed to really address that by adding into the regulation the fact that solicit means to ask a request explicitly or implicitly, which would be, I think, an important change in the regulations. Again, I think that's where the regulation has been over the last few years. I think that's how we've always intended it to operate, but I think it would take that issue off the table and make very clear to everybody that that's how the regulation operates. The second key thing that the proposed regulations would do is also make clear that a solicitation must be limited to unambiguous appeals for funds. I view this as a cardinal concept that must guide us in this area. Because whatever we do, in my view, if we potentially cover even statements that are ambiguous and potentially subject federal office holders and party officials to liability for statements that they say that are ambiguous, I think that's a very serious problem in terms of the fair administration of law, in terms of fair notice to political actors. And I think we're well within our bounds. In fact, I think we're required to make clear in whatever regulations we issue in this area that there is a fundamental requirement that the statements at issue be unambiguous. And I don't think that's inconsistent at all with having the rule of reach indirect or implicit statements as well as explicit statements. And in that regard, and I'll be prepared to talk more at length today on this now, just briefly note, page 106 of the Circuit Court ruling in Shays, I think there are some important passages in that ruling that can, I think, stand for two propositions. One, of course, the court was concerned that they were reading our rules only reaching explicit pitches for money, but I think also importantly, their concern was that, in their view, and I'm reading really from the left-hand column of page 106 of the Federal Reporter, that we would be still allowing other types of pitches for money, but they would be clear pitches for money. And the phraseology the court uses repeatedly is, I'm just reading here, anything that makes their intention clear without overtly asking for money, the circuit court indicates. Again, I think that our current rule is never limited to just explicit pitches, but I take from that passage the appropriateness and perhaps even the requirement that the statements at issue have to be clear and that the circuit court is recognizing that. They also, on the right-hand column of page 106, make a similar statement with respect to and they use the same terminology in terms of clear statements. I'll be prepared to talk more about what I take from that passage of the opinion, but I don't see anything in the circuit court ruling that is inconsistent with this agency making clear that only unambiguous appeals for funds are covered. And then the third thing that the current that the proposal would attempt to do is also take off the table something that I think all the commenters were comfortable with. I don't recall any commenter objecting to this, but to make clear that solicitation, the restrictions on solicitations in the McCain-Feingold law are limited to political speech that is about fundraising, and in no way restricts other types of political speech. You know, general statements of political support for a candidate or for an organization, that these rules that we're talking about today are focused on necessarily fundraising appeals and are not in any way, do not in any way restrict other types of political speech that have nothing to do with soliciting contributions. I think that's a very important concept that we put in the regulations, and I don't recall any commenter objecting to that. And the final thing in terms of the proposal that Commissioner Mason and Von Spakovsky and I have offered is a series of communications that in our view are per se solicitations. And the NPRM had noted this concept, but certain things revolving around reply cards and response devices and communications that facilitate the making of contributions. And so the agenda document tries to go through and identify a few discrete categories there. Where I think our view is that however those types of devices are phrased or constructed, they are per se solicitations because, as a practical matter, they are involved in facilitating the making of contributions. So those are the major goals in terms of the agenda document that's put forward today. The main goal is to really focus on the heart of the concern, as I understand it, from the circuit court, that we really must cover implicit as well as explicit pitches for money, but at the same time also make clear that there's a cardinal concept that only unambiguous appeals for funds should lead to potential prosecution under the McCain-Feingold law. So with that, that's the major goals of the agenda document put forward today from me and my colleagues. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that I'd like to begin by noting that that we agree, you and I agree, I think, on the framework of the problem that presents itself here, although we have somewhat different solutions. In 2002, Congress passed BCRA, and one of the most important features of that bill that became a law was the prohibition on the raising and spending of soft money. The centerpiece of that was a ban on candidates soliciting, receiving, directing, transferring, or spending funds that were not subject to the restrictions of the Act. And somewhat similar restrictions were placed on political parties. The FEC took on the task of trying to define what it meant to solicit or direct funds, and in that year came out with a rule that at its core said that to solicit means to ask. And this problem presents itself to us today because the Court of Appeals found that that did not meet the Chevron standards, and principally because it failed to, in the eyes of the court, capture indirect requests. The proposal that we've put forward cures that. And the means by which we have gone about doing that is by expanding the definitions or the words used to define what constitutes a solicitation or to solicit, to include, to ask, to suggest, or recommend. And the word suggest has been brought in here because the courts found that that fairly captured the concept of what would constitute an indirect request for funds. Our rule goes on and talks about the solicitation as being either oral or written, explicit or implicit, and is to be construed as as reasonably understood in context, as well as the notion that conduct can be used to define what the context was. And I'd like to talk a little bit about our adding of the notion that these should be construed as reasonably understood in context. What I think we're trying to get at here is that we're using an objective test, that the concerns that have been raised that a donor could misconstrue the solicitation, and that we would use a standard that would view this as the donor viewed it, is not the test we're using. And I am mindful of the Court of Appeals language talking about a solicitation as a communication that is intended to and reasonably understood to convey a request. Our inclusion, I think, of the notion of reasonableness is to try and construe these solicitations in the context in which they're made. That the meanings of words vary somewhat depending upon the context in which they're spoken. Finally, we've added a larger number of examples, largely in response to requests that by the regulated community that we do so, that we provide as much clarity as possible what these words mean, and so more so than the version the chairman has signed on to, we've really tried to sort of lay out how these terms would be construed in a range of different contexts. In some, our efforts, I think, has been to try to overcome the constraints the Court of Appeals saw in our earlier rule, and hopefully we've done so. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Why don't we plan to have a good discussion of the various issues. We certainly have been working internally for some weeks, and seems even longer than that, on these issues, but why don't we just open the floor and have a general discussion of these key issues. Would anyone like to begin?
We can't have said it all.
Yeah, that would be a first.
Sure.
Commissioner Mason.
Thank you. I obviously signed on to one of the proposals here and support that, but I want to note that while I'll have some unsupportive, non-supportive comments about my colleague's proposal, I appreciate what they've done in putting something forward, and I agree there was sort of sense in the chairman's and the vice chairman's comments that we're not that far away. There are different proposals. I think there are important differences. But I think there are actually a lot of elements of agreement, and so I don't want to miss that in the context of sort of naturally focusing our discussion on the elements of differences. And I want to start off by going back to the question of the definition of solicit. And I guess make the point that I believe solicit has a relatively narrow and relatively definite meaning. For instance, in the plaintiff's brief in the district court, they cite Webster's dictionary definition that includes to seek eagerly or actively to seek to effect, to make petition to, and to strongly urge. Now, all of those are, to me, pretty vigorous, definite terms, not terribly subtle. And I think that follows through in other dictionary definitions, from Webster's, to make petition to approach with a request or plea, to urge strongly, to entice or allure, especially into evil, which we don't want. Synonym, see ask.
We did try that.
American Heritage, to seek to obtain by persuasion, entreaty, or formal application, to petition persistently, importune, to entice or incite to evil action again. Webster's Legal Dictionary, to ask, induce, advise, or command a person to do something, especially regarding a crime, to attempt to persuade to purchase something, to attempt to bring about or obtain by soliciting. So I think when you look at the dictionary definitions of solicit, they're actually direct type definitions, not things that naturally would suggest subtle or indirect meanings. And when you look at the thesaurus, at least Roget's online thesaurus, suggests 54 synonyms for solicit, and not one of the 54 is suggest. It does say ask, it does say request, require, it says a whole lot of other things such as supplicate, tout, whistle for, that we probably wouldn't want to include in the definition. But suggest just isn't there. So I conclude that suggest is not a particularly close fit for solicit, and I think that would be a normal place to start in terms of our consideration about whether that is an appropriate substitute or synonymous term that's helpful in defining this. I'm even more troubled when you turn actually to the definitions of suggest, which call to mind by thought or association is the one closest in Webster's that to what I think must be meant. To bring to mind by logic or association, a cloud that suggests a mushroom, a ring-like symbol suggesting unity. To make evident indirectly, intimate, or imply. Example, a silence that suggested disapproval. Now, of course, our problem is that we're being told in some cases maybe silence suggests approval. Those are places that I don't want to go. And it actually is interesting when you go over to suggestion, a closely related word, where a couple of the definitions, this is from American Heritage, the sequential process by which one thought or mental image leads to another, a psychological process by which an idea is induced in or adopted by another without argument, command, or coercion. What I find is that that definition or that aspect of suggest or suggestion is the soul of subjectivity. And I'm in agreement with my colleagues that we need to be looking at objective standards. And while suggest certainly can have aspects that can be rendered objectively, it also has these other subjective elements that have to do largely with impressions that are formed in the mind of someone who hears something or sees something, which are not in the control of and weren't necessarily meant by the person speaking. Now, of course, we could try to address that by a further definition of suggest or by ENJ language, but I don't think in terms of and in the context of Commissioner Weintraub reminded me this tricky business of using words to define words, I don't think that word is particularly apt because I think it has such a variety of meanings, some of which are inappropriate, for us to then go and try to solve that by massaging it in the E&J or something like that, when what we're trying to do is bring clarity to the definition of solicit. And so that's why I think that word in particular is not useful. But I also want to think about sort of the exercise of rendering legislative intent, which the courts tried to do, and obviously we're trying to do, and we're being urged in part by the sponsors, who are legislators and supporters, and that's to ask the question, what would Congress do, or what would Congress have done? And let's imagine for some reason that Congress didn't want to use the term solicit. Maybe they wanted to reserve that term for hard money, for requests, for hard money contributions, and they wanted to use another term for asking for, requesting non-hard money contributions. They might well have used ask. They might well have used request. I believe that they would not have used the term suggest. That term, had it been offered in legislation in Congress, would have been rejected. They would have found other terms, and I think that's because of the potential vagueness of the meaning, the potentially subjective aspects to it. And for that reason, I think we, as we sort of try to imagine, again, what would Congress have done if they had wanted to or needed to use some term other than solicit, I would think they would have rejected suggest. I also want to support the chairman's comments about the issue of ambiguity. I think it's important, and it's important in this rule in two different ways. One is in the First Amendment context, where normally regulation of ambiguous statements is frowned upon. And the last couple of rounds from the courts have not thought about that or not address First Amendment aspects very directly or perhaps very carefully. But with this rule, where we're looking at speeches by office holders, both drafts try and adequately do address written solicitations, letters, things like that. And so really the differences have to do with what happens when a politician is up there on stage and making a speech or is talking to people in perhaps some smaller group, classic First Amendment activity. And in that arena, I think the concerns about vagueness are best put. And again, because we have some special rules addressing written solicitations, these applications in terms of vagueness really are only going to come into play when we're talking about spoken words that often are going to be in the context of political campaigns, political advocacy, and so on like that. The other reason I think the ambiguity issue is important is because of the criminal penalties, increased criminal penalties in BCRA that we have seen being prosecuted out across the country in a lot of different contexts. And I think we need to contemplate that whatever regulation we write will be used in the course of criminal prosecutions. And I've talked to the staff about this question, had some back and forth, and they very helpfully have kind of pointed out something with which I very much agree, that to be criminal, it has to be a knowing and willful violation. And so, for instance, if we adopt an objective test here for a simple violation, the knowing and willful element required for a criminal violation would turn that back into a subjective test. And you would have to prove something in the mind of the politician making the request. Still, I think it's dangerous to start down a road that says ambiguous conduct or ambiguous speech is going to be deemed to be a violation when there's a criminal penalty at the end of that road. So I think it's important to read out ambiguity. I take some encouragement in the idea that my colleagues, I'm not sure exactly what they mean, but on page 2 of their proposal, when they're talking about conduct, at line 10, they note, I'm surprised, I think there's a split infinitive here, and I can't imagine.
Mr. Weintraub didn't catch it. While conduct is often ambiguous, sometimes it is not. And it goes on to give an example of which I think everyone would agree that the conduct was not ambiguous. The suggestion there, if I can use that term, is that ambiguous conduct maybe wouldn't be prosecuted. And I would agree that an ambiguous silence, by my earlier definition, ambiguous as to whether it applied, perhaps explicitly implied disapproval, rather than explicitly implied approval, or maybe implied nothing at all, certainly wouldn't be something that we would want to prosecute. And so I think that's something that that I think is important to have in the rule and to state in the rule, and in terms of looking at, assuming everybody is at the end of this morning or the end of today where they are coming in, as we go forward to sort of explore that concept and see if we can't agree that we don't want to pursue ambiguous conduct and find a way to state that in such a way that we're not simply undoing what I think we all agree that we want to get both direct and indirect, or I think it's stated in the rules as explicit and implicit, but not things that are ambiguous. Finally, I'd note that the other sort of big difference was addressed by the vice chairman, I think, in the two approaches, and that's just in the structure of the rule, and designated as the B version of the rule is more complex, and it does have the argument for it that it gives more specific examples and therefore more guidance, and that's not an unreasonable way to go, but. In terms of a rule that is simple and clear, I'm not sure we always end up at the end of the day with a more clear rule by adding more and more examples. It does help as to those particular examples, but as we all know, our problem in the enforcement context is these darn actors in the political process won't limit themselves to the examples that we already laid out, and so I think the more specific examples are going to be of limited help in helping us apply the rule, and may make it a little more difficult, arguably, and again I think it's a debatable point, but I think that's something that we need to think about and discuss as we try to work out something that ultimately I would hope six of us could agree on. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We seem to be bouncing back and forth, so I think it's my turn. I have a really simple goal here, and that is that if we end up back in court again over this rule, next time I want to win. I just want to win. I'm tired of losing, and I want to win. And I think that was something that was high on our list of motivating factors when we tried to figure out how to go forward. And I think it's useful to look at things like dictionary definitions, but I think that would be a more useful process if we were starting from square one, and we're not. We've sort of gone around on this, and the courts have spoken on this, and we're a small agency with a limited budget, and we've got a lot of work to do, and I know this is something that the chairman and I were both agreeing on this morning. We are going to be so happy to see the end of these Shays rulemakings. Sometimes it feels like that movie Groundhog Day, where we wake up every morning and the same song is playing on the radio, and we are
very good song, by the way.
I don't remember the song. I'm sure it was wonderful, but
Sonny and Cher. It's
And we're still confronting the same issues that we've dealt with before. And I'd really like to move on and deal with some new issues, because there are plenty of them out there. And I think I know how to win, because I think the court pretty much laid it out for us. The court seemed to be very persuaded that the deletion of the word suggest was what made our rule impermissibly narrow. the first time around. And I think if we put back those three verbs that we started out with that the council recommended 2.5 years ago, ask, suggest, and recommend. If we put them back in the rule and we don't say anything else after that that unduly restricts our interpretation of those words, we win. It's easy. I'm willing to bet money on it, and I'm not much of a gambler. We also included explicitly in our rule the two hypotheticals that the court was persuaded were not covered under the old rule that was struck down. And we explicitly put them in there in the examples. I think, you know, we can, it's not a deal breaker for me whether we have a lot of examples in the rule or whether we put them in the E and J, but I think that it is critical that we address the specific hypotheticals that the court was concerned about and make sure that we assure the court that they're covered. So we put them right in the rule, so there'll be no ambiguity about whether those scenarios are covered or not. They're in there. And I think that if we adopted the rule that my colleagues and I have put forward or something close to it, not only would we win, but we might not even be sued. And that would be even better. Because as a small agency with limited resources and in current budgetary times, I don't anticipate that situation's going to change. I think it would be irresponsible of me to vote for anything that I didn't think would withstand judicial scrutiny, and that I was fairly well convinced of it. Not in doubt, but, you know, thinking, well, maybe it will, maybe it won't, and if it doesn't, we can always come back and fix it again. I want to be really convinced this time that we're going to win. And I think we do win with this. And I've, you know, looked at the court opinion many, many times. I've talked to our lawyers, and I'm convinced that our version wins. I'm not convinced that your version wins. It might, but I'm not convinced of it. And that's why I can't vote for it, because I don't want to commit our agency resources to almost certain litigation, I think. That's my prediction. And a very iffy chance of winning. And I want to, when I mentioned a couple of times the agency resources, I want to acknowledge, because it's not apparent from the two drafts that are on the table, which come forward from commissioners' offices, the enormous amount of work that went into the background in the last few weeks on these proposals by the staff, by Rosie and by Brad and by their team. A lot. I'm not going to try to name all the lawyers that worked on this, but really, people have spent an awful lot of time on this, and I'm sure that they, like we, would be happy to wake up one morning and not have the same song playing on the radio and be able to move on to other things. I know that some people are concerned about the word suggest, but, you know, when we got to the hearing and I asked people for actual concrete examples, real-world examples of what they were concerned about, what they thought would be captured by suggest that shouldn't be captured by a solicitation rule, I got nothing. Nobody came up with anything for me. And if you think this rule is vague, I suppose there's the possibility that somebody could sue on the other side, but I'm actually willing to take that litigation risk, because reading this opinion, the circuit court's opinion in Shays, I think if somebody sues on the other side and says we think suggest is too ambiguous to be sustained under a First Amendment analysis, I think we win on that one too. I'm confident enough that I'd be willing to take that risk. I don't think there's anybody at this table who's going to say, boy, I want to capture a lot of ambiguous statements and conduct out there. That's what I think our rule ought to cover. I don't think anybody wants to do that. But I think when you put into the rule that it's got to be unambiguous, well, surprisingly enough, I find that an ambiguous statement. I'm not sure what it means that the statement has to be unambiguous. I'm not sure that, the court said that we had to capture, as I think the chairman quoted earlier, anything that makes these so-called solicitors' intention clear without overtly asking for money, and the court specifically referred to winks, nods, and circumlocutions. I don't know whether circumlocutions are captured by a rule that says it has to be totally unambiguous. I just don't know the answer to that. I don't know how unambiguous it has to be to meet those criteria. Does that mean it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt? Does that mean that there is no conceivable interpretation that somebody can come up with that would say, well, you know, maybe it really looks like a solicitation, but it wasn't? Because we can come up with another hypothetical for what the words might have meant, even though maybe the commissioners would not think it was a reasonable interpretation of those rules. So I'm not convinced that that the draft that my colleagues have put forward, and I appreciate that people feel strongly about these things, but my bottom line is that I'm not convinced that yours would win, and I am convinced that ours would win. And that's why I'm voting for ours, and I'm not voting for yours. And I think that, you know, it's been pointed out that there's a lot of areas of agreement. I think in a lot of ways we're not that far apart. I'm a little disappointed that we're not closer together already at this point, but I think that we can find a solution to this. We can find the right words that would satisfy everybody, or at least four of us. I don't want to. It would be nice to get six of us, but boy, I'd be satisfied with four. Four votes and on a rule that I think would withstand judicial scrutiny, and I'm there. I'm happy with that. Six would be better, but four is good enough. I think we can do it. I really think if people try, we can do it. We can get there, and I hope that we're going to do it. But that, we'll see. But I think we can and we should, and the words are out there. I'm convinced of it. But, you know, between these two options that are on the table today, I know which one I'm supporting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
I do want to thank the OGC for all the work you did on trying to put these drafts together, and I also want to thank my Democratic colleagues on the commission for putting your draft together. I know it was a lot of work, as it was on our side also. And, you know, it's very clear this is a difficult topic, and we've worked hard to try to come to an agreement on this. But I have to say that while we have to respect the court's decision and do what the court has directed us to do, I don't believe fear of litigation should drive the decisions that we make here today. Because if we do that, we're not going to do what is correct under the law and under the statute and, frankly, under our Constitution. We are dealing here with something today that is a very delicate area. You know, on the one hand, Congress said it wanted to regulate solicitation of contributions. On the other hand, we have to be sure that we are not regulating and chilling political speech. And we have to find the correct balance between the two. Commissioner Mason has dealt very well with the word suggest, which I think is too broad and should not be included. I had some help from my 12-year-old daughter who showed me where you could go to dictionary.com. And so I also looked on at thesaurus, and suggest is not in there at all. There are some other words that probably most candidates would tell you do describe what they have to do when they solicit, like beg, bum, hustle, mooch, seduce, and I especially like whistle for. But obviously we're not going to include that in the regulation.
I like mooch.
I don't think it is a good method of writing statutes and regulations to include hypotheticals in the regulation. I think that, to use an inartful word, junks up the regulation, makes it too complicated. I think those belong in an E&J, not in the regulation itself. Some of the hypotheticals, I think, that are included in this version do include ambiguous conduct. I mean, for example, 1B, if a candidate says, Group X has always been there for me immediately after Group X has made a solicitation, why then the candidate has made a solicitation. Well, that means whether or not he's made a solicitation depends on the timing. The word immediate, well, what does that mean? If he gets up right away and immediately says, Group X has always been for me, it's a solicitation, but if he gives a 45-minute speech about public policy, and at the end of it says, you know, thank you very much for having invited me here today, Group X has always been for me, well, is that no longer a solicitation because it's not immediately? I mean, the candidate's going to be put in a position of negotiating when exactly they're speaking on the program, because the timing is relevant to whether they've made a solicitation or not, even though they haven't directly asked for money. I mean, under those circumstances, we might as well issue a stopwatch with the FEC logo on it so that people can time when they make this statement. I mean, I don't want to joke about it, but that seems to be what it brings us to. Another example is M1C, where we're talking about the person nodding at just the right moment when a question is asked. Again, the timing of a gesture would determine whether or not you've made a solicitation. Did you make it right after some question was asked? Was it 5 seconds later? Was it 15 seconds later? Let's hope the person doesn't get a piece of lint in their eye and blinks at the wrong time, because, my God, they've made a solicitation. And trying to investigate these, it's not a bright line rule. What we're going to be put into a situation of is we're going to have to do a case-by-case investigation, talking to witnesses in the room who are going to have to tell us, well, did the person nod? Well, how much of a nod was it? When exactly did they nod? You know, how is a candidate going to defend themselves in that situation? And if it's a case-by-case investigation every time, basically we're put in this position of you're going to have to wait for the government to tell you whether what you have said is acceptable or not. I think we have to define solicit so that we clearly say that it has to be an unambiguous appeal for money. Anything else is going to not be a bright line rule and is going to chill political speech. You know, another example is 1E, where we say that a donor, if you imply a donor will incur a benefit, it satisfies the solicit definition. Well, how far? It's certainly true if you're asking for money that that's going to apply. But if you're saying there's some intangible benefit, well, how far do we go with that? You know, if someone says it means a great deal to the entire party and to me personally when they're giving a speech, that's a standard phrase people use in all kinds of political speeches, and we're suddenly going to say you can't say that because you're going to be in trouble and violating the regulation if you do so. This is going to chill political speech to such an extent that candidates might as well not say anything. They'll never be able to talk about any kind of finances at any kind of meeting, because if they do, they'll immediately be covered under this kind of a rule. I think we need a bright line rule, one that doesn't chill political speech, and I mean, I can't vote for something that includes suggest and includes ambiguous conduct that doesn't give the general public an understanding of what can and can't be done. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Walther.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to thank Council once again for the work they've done. It has been really good work on this difficult thing, more difficult than I think we probably all realized when we started out. I think there is a basis for common ground on a number of these points. I'm not sure about all of them, but I do think there is, and I was glad to hear Chairman Toner say that he agrees that it's implicit and explicit and indirect and direct requests. We agree on that. It's in the court decision. Now we have to find out language that will give us sufficient comfort on both sides to make that the basic message. I think that's true. I think we look at suggest in our particular draft because it already has some, you can call it baggage, or it's got some history of meaning. And the court did say that by taking, lopping off, I think the word was lopping off, the word suggest and recommend, took away the indirect request requirement. And not to say there aren't other words, but we have those words available to us, discussed by the court, gives us some kind of a safe harbor about how that would be interpreted in the future, I think. So I think those are reasonable words to cling to, not that they have to be the only words, but I think they give some solace that they've been through the thought process once before, and we kind of know how they're to be interpreted. On the other point of unambiguous, I haven't looked, actually I probably should have, in the Webster's and all the various other dictionaries to see how unambiguous is defined, but I'm not sure we'd all agree on all the different types of ways that would be described. I think our approach was to take a similar concept and say construed as reasonably understood in the context in which it was made. The context may include the conduct of persons present or otherwise involved in the communication. The court, I think, also made clear that conduct is a factor, and timing necessarily would be a factor if you talk about conduct as well. It might not necessarily be at the very moment the speech is made, but in the context of the way it is made, timing may make a difference. Now, I don't think we can always define when that is, but to a large degree, by our definition, when it says reasonably understood in the context in which it was made, we're kind of saying we know it when we see it. There is some language like that in the Supreme Court, you may recall. But I think it gives us a basis to say there are very few things that can be ambiguous if you really want to stretch a word or stretch a phrase or stretch a sentence. But if you put it in context, if you look at what a reasonable understanding is, call it plain words or whatever, I think we get there. And if we just use solicit alone, I don't think that word is in and of itself void for vagueness. I think what we're trying to do here is to put a little meat on the bones and try and give a greater methodology in our case that would be a little more of a bright line, recognizing that there's no magic way to magic words or magic definition that's always going to get there with the same precision in every case. So this is our approach, and at this point I'm still convinced that's a reasonable approach to take. On the other issue of the examples, in this case we can look at ourselves, and we've had a very difficult time coming up with a way to convey what we otherwise would thought was a fairly simple message. Not everybody in the community is going to be looking at the explanations and justifications. In fact, many people where the rubber hits the road, they don't get there. But they will hopefully at least get to the regulations. And in doing so, it kind of gives us, I think, to the average person out there who's going to be trying to comply with this, trying to figure out what we mean, even though we say I'm unambiguous, it's a good policy in this case, but not always, to give some examples of how it can be seen in both directions. So I think in this case, regulations can be helpful to people who don't live this every day, aren't familiar with all the litigation, aren't familiar with the explanations and justifications, which our drafts are quite long. So I'd argue for including them in this particular case.
Thank you. I appreciate Commissioner Walther's comments emphasizing, I think, a key ingredient that unites all six of us here, which is that direct as well as indirect pitches for funds must be covered as a matter of law. I think the commissioner is right about that, and I think we have a unanimity on the need to do that. And I think he also hit the nail on the head that when you go beyond that then there are more difficult issues. But I do think we have broad agreement on the need to address that core concept and nail it down in the regulations. And I think on the question of ambiguity, I think it's an important point that whatever standard we apply, there always will be a fact finder who has to decide whether or not a particular communication triggers the standard. And that would include if we had a standard that said, hey, unambiguous appeals are excluded. It would still be left to the fact finder whether this agency or Department of Justice or somebody else to make a determination of whether or not a particular communication was or was not ambiguous. And I think that we'll never be able to get away from that, no matter what regulatory language we adopt. But my point, I think, more fundamentally is that it should be part of the standard, because I think it's a core concept of fair notice. And I don't think it's inconsistent with the circuit court ruling, particularly the emphasis in the circuit court ruling on clear statements from the page 106 of the opinion. Now, I concede that reasonable people could disagree about particular communications. Are they ambiguous? Are they not ambiguous? And I don't think we're ever going to solve all those problems. But I do think we could perhaps have common ground that it has to be unambiguous. Because if we don't have even that, if we're going to basically say that actually we reserve the right to prosecute even ambiguous statements or statements that are not clear on their face, I do have a real problem with that. Some of the commenters talked about, and I think the Commissioner Walther sort of used this phraseology, is it plainly a solicitation? Is it plainly a solicitation? And I think that captures the key element, directly or indirectly, explicitly or implicitly. But at the end of the day, is the pitch for funds been made plain in the real world of politics? I think that's an appropriate standard for us to be in. And again, whether particular communications would meet that standard would always have to be up to the trier of fact, and there would be, I think, honest debates about that. But I do think that that's a key should be a key ingredient of whatever standard we adopt here. And I feel sort of similarly about the point that, to make clear in the regulation, that we're not intending to cover any other type of political speech that doesn't involve pitches for funds, appeals for funds. There's a sort of a corollary of that, that we don't mean to restrict in any way the political speech of office holders and candidates when it doesn't concern fundraising. And that we say that in the plainest possible terms in the regulation. And I don't recall commenters objecting to that, at least in concept. Now, they may quibble with how we ought to accomplish it. But I do appreciate Commissioner Walther's comment emphasizing that I think we do have strong agreement on the need to cover indirect as well as direct pitches for funds, and that's a key concept that I think unites all of us. And then we get into these other issues, which are admittedly difficult, but I do agree with him on that point. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, sir. The longer I stay here, the less optimistic I am that we have unity. I am troubled, deeply troubled, by including a concept or a phrasing of this rule that would prohibit enforcement of this provision in any circumstance in which there was any ambiguity as to what the communication was. I don't think that it's certainly not the way I read the Court of Appeals decisions. I read that per the use of that word in a single point when they're describing the winks and nods and the need for those to be unambiguous communications. Or the word unambiguous appears in that. I think throughout, in a numerous points in the decision, the court describes a need to identify that the party that is making the solicitation intended to do that, and it was perceived of as that. But I do not see anything that resembles a requirement that this agency prove that it be unambiguous. And I am deeply concerned that our capacity to enforce this provision of BCRA in the context of indirect requests for funds is placing an enormously high hurdle on us in any circumstance in which, or in all circumstances in which a respondent can find any ambiguity in the statement that they made, the prosecution stops. We've discussed among ourselves, any statement that includes multiple clauses to which a candidate agrees, generally, will later afford that individual the ability to come back and successfully defend against enforcement by saying, "I was agreeing with one of the clauses of that statement, but not the other," regardless of what their intent was when they spoke. And I don't think that we're I both think that we are not obligated to do that by the appellate court decision, and I do not, and I think that it raises an enormously high hurdle for our enforcement of the prohibition on solicitations in the context of indirect solicitations.
Would you basically be reserving the right to prosecute even ambiguous statements at some level?
Well, I think that there... I would reserve the right to prosecute cases in which the meaning was clear, though the party may claim that there was an alternative meaning that we find not to be credible. We routinely make decisions as to credibility, as to the facts and circumstances around which things occur in trying to interpret their meaning, and that the fact that a respondent may claim that they meant something else, we would certainly find circumstances where that was not credible and would proceed, yeah.
But if we were the trier of fact and we determined that the statement as a whole was unambiguous, under the approach that I'm advocating, that would govern, as opposed to the arguments that are often advanced here that we reject, that we don't find to be credible, versus not even having that be part of the standard in the first place that we would have to apply. So I guess I agree with you that there could be circumstances where respondents would come in and say, hey, I didn't intend to solicit those funds, or it's ambiguous what I was saying or what I was agreeing to. But in my mind, if this agency concluded as a matter of law that it was unambiguous, that there would be liability. But my point is, I think that's got to be a key part of our analysis in the area. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think maybe we might advance the game a little bit if we moved away from the term unambiguous, because I think the term unambiguous means different things to different people at this table, which is ironic, but true. And, you know, maybe we do need to focus on other words like clear or plain or just something else. We can work on that. I'm more troubled by the prospect that, you know, what I always thought was that we might argue about the words, but that if it got down to particular scenarios, we'd probably agree. I'm a little troubled by some of the hypotheticals that Commissioner Von Spakovsky is troubled by. I'm troubled that he's troubled, because I don't find them to be ambiguous. And I, you know, got to go back to where I started. I don't think the court would find it ambiguous if we were to say in our explanation and justification that we're not going to cover the statement. It would mean a lot to me if you would make a contribution to the party, because that's too ambiguous. I have no doubt what this court would say about that. I don't think this court would find that ambiguous. I don't find it ambiguous. So that's a little troubling to me. It was interesting to me. I was in an unrelated meeting with another lawyer, as it turns out, yesterday, and I was struck by how many things he conveyed to me without opening his mouth. And, you know...
The lawyer who didn't do any speaking.
Yeah, he was a lawyer. He was, you know, I mean, somebody that I knew pretty well, but still, you know, he raised his eyebrow, he smirked, he did this, he did that. And I understood with 100% clarity every single one of those gestures. Now, I'm not proposing that we include smirks in our rule, but I do think that conduct can be unambiguous even. I think nodding yes to a question, you know, not sort of generally standing there in the middle of a conversation and somebody makes a speech and 3 minutes later you nod and, you know, please don't even get me started on the stopwatch. But, you know, if somebody asks a question and the person nods their head, I don't think that's ambiguous whatsoever. So I'm troubled that you do. But I want to say a word about fear of litigation, because them's fighting words. And I'm not afraid of a fight. You weren't here, Commissioner Von Spakovsky, when as we went through the litigation on this. But I wasn't here when this rule was adopted. It's not my rule. I don't have any investment in it whatsoever. I'm not sure I would have voted for it if I'd been here at the time. But when it was challenged in court and it was struck down in the district court, it was very important to my Republican colleagues that we defend this rule. This definition, not this definition, but the one that got struck down, the definition of solicitous ask. It was very important to them. And I thought there was a plausible reading of ask. If you read it broadly enough, it could cover all the scenarios that the plaintiffs were worried about. That was always my understanding of how I was going to interpret it. And I crossed over. I crossed party lines. I reached out to my colleagues on the other side. I thought that it was important for this agency, for this institution, to defend its own regulations that four commissioners were willing to vote for, even if I wasn't one of those four commissioners. I thought there was an institutional interest at stake, and it was a plausible argument that could win, and I was willing to supply the fourth vote. And without my vote, we wouldn't even have gotten to the circuit court, and my colleagues know that. What?
It's not Commissioner Weintraub's fault, but we'd have been better off.
Well, I'm not sure I did you any favors. But you really wanted the vote at the time.
Yes, we did.
And I took some heat for that. And that was okay, because I've taken heat for all sorts of things since I've been at this agency, and that's okay too. But I'm not afraid of litigation. I'm not afraid of making a good argument and seeing where it takes us if I'm committed to what we're doing in the first place. But I'm not willing to go into litigation that I think is a loser. I don't see the point to doing that. I just don't see it. And it's not that I'm afraid. It's just I think it's a waste of time. It's a waste of resources. And I would really, you know, we've been there, done that on the losing end, and I would really like to try to get the regulations right this time and get them to a place that the court will approve of. And we don't have to all agree with the court. We don't all have to like the court. I'm aware that there are people in Washington probably who will argue at a lunch today that the court didn't know what it was doing and doesn't understand the Constitution. That's fine. People are entitled to their opinions on that. But what we don't have the option of doing is not complying with the court. I think we have to respond to the court. We have to look at the way the court looks at the law, and we have to come up with a rule that's going to comply with that. And that's what I'm trying to do here. And I'm not wedded to any particular words. We can talk. I am hopeful that there will be somebody on the other side of the aisle who will be willing to do what I did and reach out to this side of the table and try and work with us to find something that will withstand judicial scrutiny. Because I know that I'm not prepared to vote for anything that I am not personally convinced will withstand judicial scrutiny. And I don't think there's anybody on this side of the table who's willing to do that. And I don't want to speak for my colleagues, but that's my sense of it. So, you know, I was willing to cross the line, and I'm hoping that somebody else will be willing to cross the line. If we get six votes, that would be great. I'd settle for four.
I think we all do a good job of crossing over on issues. I think each of us make our own judgment about that, but I think all of us have a pretty good track record of doing that in a wide variety of settings. I just want to follow up, Commissioner Weintraub, as you indicated, and I think you make a fair point that the particular language used, particularly when you're dealing with five lawyers on this panel, Commissioner Mason has the advantage of not being the sixth. But, you know, you make a good point about, you know, what does unambiguous mean versus ambiguous, and that perhaps other types of phrases could be better suited, like clear or plain and that kind of thing. And I guess my question would be, if would you be open at some level to having in the regulation text that kind of concept, and maybe wouldn't turn on unambiguous appeals, but instead would turn on clear appeals or plain appeals? It would be a similar framework, but I think you make a good point that language is tough and we have to work through it, and I was just wondering if that's something that you could be open to.
I absolutely am open to that. I wouldn't have said it if I weren't. But I think that given the inherent ambiguity of words, I think what we really need to do is to not only agree on words, but to get an E&J that we can agree on. Because without the E&J, I'm not going to be confident that we all understand the words that we're using in the same way, and I'm not sure that the court will be in a position, if we get to court, to evaluate what we meant by those words. And I don't want to adopt a rule and then find out that we all thought we were in agreement on the words, but in fact we weren't quite in agreement on the underlying concepts, and we can't come up with an E&J that satisfies everybody. So I don't think that that's a terribly productive exercise. So I think that when we, I could sort of predict how this was going to go before I walked into the room today, but and I suspect other people could have as well, but I think that as we go forward with this, that's what we need to do. We need to work on language of the rule, but we also need to work on an E&J that we can all agree on.
It would be good to get to the point of working on an E&J. Of course, we've got to have regs language that people are comfortable with, but I agree with you that that will be a good problem to have when we get to that. But I want to make sure I understand that you would be comfortable in concept with the regs language making plain that clear appeals are covered. That is a key predicate.
I'm not going to say here, you know, because I don't think we can write this at the table today, but, you know, so I'm not going to say, oh, clear is the word or plain is the word or something is the word. I think unambiguous is not the word, but I think there are other words that can capture what you're trying to capture that I personally would be willing to support.
Okay, I think that's important because I think it's a key concept. For me, it's one of the most important concepts we've got on the table here, so I completely appreciate
the concerns of the regulated community as well, that they want to know what the rule means, and I want them to know what the rule means.
Absolutely. Thank you. Commissioner Mason.
Let me try some lawyer stuff here because there was...
You may be the best lawyer at the table.
A couple of things that Commissioner Lenhardt said that I think maybe unintentionally were confusing in that regard, and that was specifically in talking about this ambiguous issue, and by the way, I think it's a productive suggestion that we look at other words, and that I think gives us something to work on. But a couple of times Commissioner Lenhardt said there might be some ambiguity because the respondent would argue as to what their intent was. But as I understand it, intent is, again, one of those classic subjective things. You know, when somebody in a criminal statute intentionally does something, it's a subjective test. While I understand his concern about, my colleague's concern about, it's a little like the phrase, and I've mentioned this to a couple of my colleagues, in the express advocacy regulation where it's something like no other reasonable interpretation or no other reasonable meaning. And, you know, that becomes a pretty tough hurdle that somebody can't throw out something that, you know, that doesn't pass the Laugh test as, you could interpret it this way. Not likely, but is it possible? Yeah, and that is a tough test, and I don't think that's what the chairman means when he talks about unambiguous. It's not what I mean, but I think it's particularly important as we think about it and go forward that we not confuse, and because I agree we ought to be looking at an objective test, that we not confuse that some argument, whether particularly plausible or not, as to the intent of the speaker gets mixed up. In other words, if we intend to create an intent or lack of intent defense, well, you know, I suppose we can do that in the reg, but I don't think that's what we're thinking about. No. I think what we're thinking about is, you know, an interpretation of the words, whether by explicitly by a reasonable person standard or something akin to that, that would avoid us having to probe the subjective intent of the speaker, but at the same time would avoid having the speaker have any ability to come in and claim that their intent was otherwise.
Yeah, let me, if I can be specific.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Yeah, if I can just be specific, I'll give you two examples, and as I look at this language, my concerns. The first is a hypothetical that says X is an effective state party organization. It needs to get as many 100,000 contributions as possible. Okay, is that an unambiguous appeal for funds, or is that a statement of fact that X is an effective party organization and it needs that money? They're just read the FEC reports, and there's huge funding imbalances. It's I find that, using an unambiguous standard, a case that we could not proceed on, because there is ambiguity as to whether that is an appeal for funds or a simple statement of fact as to the state of the world, having looked at the FEC reports. This test concerns me with that hypothetical. And as I think about the intent, what is the intent? You know, was the intent a solicitation, or was it something else? And certainly people could come in and argue that it was something other than a solicitation. Their purpose was other than to solicit. The second involves a situation where there is a candidate and a person who represents a group that is not a candidate committee and a donor. They're sitting together, and the person representing the group is making a pitch for their group about all the things they're going to do and the money they need, and ends it with a statement something to the effect of, you know, we need your financial support. Winning in 06 or 08 is essential to advancing our cause. And the candidate slaps him on the back and says, absolutely, you're absolutely right. Is it unambiguous that he's affirming the need for financial support, that winning in 06 or 08 is essential to the cause, or both? I can easily imagine that he would argue that it was ambiguous and they were in fact endorsing only the 08 essential for the cause part of the communication, not the request for financial system. It strikes me as that there is ambiguity there. Now we may decide that that's not true and vote to proceed regardless, but it is ambiguous that one could easily have meant the second part of the clause, not the first.
And I understand the ambiguity concern, and though at least as to the first example, I don't see any ambiguity. As to the second, I can imagine that gets to be the problem, that the exact words spoken and the exact reaction is the sort of thing that gets you into. But in the first example, you again talked about intent and purpose. Right? Mm-hmm. And those are words that are usually linked in the law, as I understand it, with subjective intent. And so what I'm trying to get at is as we try to work through this test, whether it's unambiguous, clear, plain, you know, whatever, that we need to understand if we're going to apply an objective test and be careful in using words that make it clear that we're applying an objective test, and that essentially in legal terms, intent and purpose are not relevant. Well, if we disagree about that, we need to identify that disagreement, because the reason is because if we agree that intent and purpose are not relevant, and that it's the words and the behavior as viewed by a reasonable person in the circumstances, then I think that in and of itself helps reduce the degree to which we're going to read or allow ambiguity or lack of clarity into some of the hypos. Because as soon as somebody says, you know, I didn't mean or whatever, we say, well, you know, sorry, what did you say?
Mr. Vice Chairman,
I think we agree for different, let me clarify. I think that the reason why I talk about intent is because as I read the appellate court decision, I see that a solicitation requires that the party making the communication intended there to be a solicitation, and that if the person did not intend there to be a solicitation, there's not. And that to the degree that early in this proceeding there was some discussion of whether simply a donor could perceive a solicitation as occurring without the speaker having intended there to be a solicitation, that is not in fact a solicitation. That there must be, that the party that making the communication must at core be trying to solicit money. If that's not what you're doing, there's not a solicitation occurring. And so I think that there is, an element of the intent or purpose of the speaker that is part of this. I don't think that in our legal analysis, I mean, that we are looking at this objectively, that we are not going to try and probe or determine what their subjective motivation is, and that there are many areas in this statute where we do not do that, that we look objectively at what words were spoken, what was printed, what appeared in the TV communication, and discern whether there was whether it was for the purpose of influencing a federal election, and we do not look at the motive of the person who made that ad or made that communication. So as I read I think that I think that we do not have a test that looks only at what the person who hears the communication perceives that to have been. and that we are looking objectively at what words were spoken, what, in my case, gestures were made, to try and discern whether what was occurring was a solicitation, was an effort to obtain funds, a donation or contribution. I hope that was clear. By the look on your face, my guess is it's not.
Commissioner Mason.
There was another element that you worked in there, which would be who, in whose position. You know, in other words, is the are the words to be read in the position of the other, i.e., the person arguably being solicited, or are the words to be read as the person speaking them, you know, might reasonably understood. And there, I mean, that's torts and contracts, right? You know, and different tests. But I still don't understand what you mean in saying that the circuit court requires intent. Again, because I'm confused specifically in this context of the court reviewing it and the court using words and terms that are shot through with legal significance, that on the one hand we say objective and subjective, and on the other hand we say intent, which again, as I understand, is usually subjective, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that this is where I'm getting the difficulty in understanding. And again, if we can get agreement about those legal categories, we actually will start to move ahead in terms of the particular language in the reg and the ENJ.
Commissioner Walther.
The reason why it seemed to me to be reasonable in the approach that we offered, unambiguous, it still has the same question, unambiguous to who? Is it the person who said it, or is it the person who heard it or saw it? So I think, correct me if I'm wrong, we are looking for something in the way of an objective standard. And to me, the best way to do it in the drafting so far, and I'm not saying this is the exclusive way to do it, is to say as reasonably understood, and everybody focus on that, in context of what happened, without having to prove intent or proving how it was understood by the listener, but what was reasonably understood in the context gives us a basis, and that phrase is in the Shays litigation and actually used by the commission in its explanations and justifications, like on page 104, as discussed twice. And it seems to me it is something that we've worked on before as a way to try and isolate it from the intent issue. But again, I don't think this has to be the only phraseology, but it's a way to get there, it seemed to me.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that it's not so much that intent is irrelevant as that we will determine intent by looking objectively at what happened, who said what to whom, and what was the context of that communication, which I think the court really requires us to do, to look at the context. Because we don't want to, A, proving intent in enforcement is notoriously difficult. We just don't want to box ourselves into saying, well, unless we can prove what was actually in the guy's head when he uttered those words, then we can't go forward. We don't want, and the problem has two sides to it. On the one hand, you don't want to have candidates who are at risk of running into donors that are going to come up with totally unreasonable interpretations of what they say. So the candidate says, "My, isn't it a lovely day?" And the donor says, "But what he really meant was, isn't it a lovely day to make a soft money contribution?" I mean, we don't want to do that to people. On the other hand, there has to be, if somebody says something that is, I don't know what to use, clear, plain, unambiguous, that any person listening to would understand to be a solicitation, and then they say, "Oh, well, I might have said show me the money, but I didn't really mean that. I meant, you know, don't you love that Jerry Maguire movie?" I think that we can't put ourselves in a box where the simple denial that that's what the guy meant is enough to have us close down the investigation and say, okay, he said he didn't mean it, and then we stop dead in our tracks. And that's, you know, so there are two ends to the subjectivity problem, and I think we're trying to avoid both of them by using an objective standard, in a sense, to determine intent.
To infer intent?
To infer intent, yeah. Yeah.
Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
I have a question, and I think it goes back to what Commissioner Lenhart was saying, which is, I guess what I don't understand is the concern here, and if I understand correctly where the other side of the table is coming from, the concern is that if a candidate makes a statement that is potentially ambiguous, there's some ambiguity as to whether it's actually a solicitation for funds or whether it's just political speech, that we are not going to investigate and prosecute that individual, and they're not going to be subject to perhaps a civil penalty or criminal prosecution. What I don't understand is the concern about that because of what I said at the beginning. We're talking about First Amendment rights here to engage in political speech. Now, there's no question that Congress has the right to and has passed a law saying we're going to regulate solicitation for federal funds. But if there's ambiguity so that we don't know, we can't really tell whether it's a solicitation or whether it's engaging in political speech, then doesn't the Constitution require us to err on the side of protecting a First Amendment right to engage in political speech? We can't prosecute in a situation like this where what they're doing may constitute a protected right. So if there's ambiguity, I guess I don't see the problem with the fact that we're not going to prosecute in that situation. I don't see how we can, given the way the First Amendment is set up.
Commissioner Weintraub.
I don't know that I disagree with you in concept, sort of up here in the clouds, talking about, you know, well, of course, if it's ambiguous, we don't want to prosecute. But I think that what we need to nail down is, you know, what you think is ambiguous is not necessarily what I think is ambiguous. And we're going to have to work that through a little bit. I have a suggestion, and, you know, we'll see whether this is a good suggestion or not. I don't want to close off anybody who still wants to talk about this, but I don't think we're going to be able to get to the end of this today. So, and I think we need to do a lot more talking amongst ourselves. And I would like to see us come to conclusion on this on a fairly short time frame. You know, I don't think we want to leave this hanging indefinitely. So I think we ought to give ourselves a limit. But I personally am ready to vote. We can go through this exercise. You know, you'll vote for your proposition, we'll vote for ours, and you know, then we can figure out where we go from there.
I think that's a very good idea. I do want to note that I do share Commissioner Von Spakovsky's thoughts about the fact that this is a First Amendment area, and you know, the court has made clear that precision of regulation is essential in this area, and they haven't totally eviscerated the First Amendment, at least not yet. So I think that is a necessary backdrop in terms of what we're doing here. And I think the key point from my perspective is, regardless of whether we had a standard that talked about how you know, the appeals have to be clear or plain or unambiguous, that we would have to then apply that to particular communications, there's no question about it, and work through that. But for me, that should be a key ingredient for any standard that we adopt. But Commissioner Weintraub has suggested that perhaps we could begin voting, but I want to make sure that there aren't any additional issues that any of my colleagues want to address, and if not, I think we can do that. Does anyone want to make a motion for adoption?
You guys want to adopt? Yeah, just a bit of procedure.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Mason.
I move approval of the rule as set forth in agenda document 06-08A.
Commissioner Mason's moved approval of agenda document 06-08A. Is there further discussion on the motion to approve? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those against?
No.
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 Motion fails on a vote of 3-3. Commissioner Von Spakovsky, Mason and Toner voting in approval. The Vice Chairman, Commissioner Weintraub, Commissioner Walther voting no. Other motions. Mr. Vice Chairman.
I'd like to move the adoption of Agenda Document 06-08B.
Vice Chairman has moved adoption of Agenda Document Number 0608B. Further discussion on the motion to adopt? Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed say no.
No.
No. Motion fails on a vote of 3-3. The Vice Chairman, Commissioner Weintraub, Commissioner Walther voting in an affirmative. Commissioner Mason, Toner, and Von Spakovsky voting no. Okay. I think we've had a good discussion today. We've certainly put out a lot of issues on the table. I do appreciate that there have been some key ingredients that have been identified that do unite us. I don't underestimate the difficulty of the issues that remain. And they're important issues. I mean, they're critical issues. But I do appreciate that there have been some key things that have been said here today that could be the building blocks for reaching consensus. And with that in mind, I would propose that we do two things. First, we are prepared to announce a schedule for the remainder of the Shays rulemakings, and the Commission plans to take up the Internet rulemaking on Thursday, March 16th, 3 weeks from today, and to take up the coordination rulemaking on Thursday, March 30th, 5 weeks from today. Those are the 8th and 9th and last of the rulemakings as
and we
required,
have a big party, right?
As required by the Shays litigation. I think Commissioner Weintraub's absolutely right. That would be very judicious of us to do that. We will plan to take up the 8th and 9th rulemakings, the Internet on March 16th, and coordination on March 30th, which would complete the 9 rulemakings as required by Shays. And also I would plan, if my colleagues are comfortable with this, that we would continue working on the issues that we've discussed here today and plan to take back up this rulemaking on Thursday, March 9th, 2 weeks from today, if that is the pleasure of my colleagues. Mr. Vice Chairman?
It is.
Okay. With that, I think that sets out the schedule for the remainder of the Shays required rulemakings. Other comments on our proceeding today? Mr. Costa, are there any administrative matters to bring to the Commission's attention?
Mr. Chairman, there are none.
Hearing none, this meeting is adjourned.